Here it is, this week's edition of the Ellison Report, our neighborhood magazine of politics, policy, and the people, presented weekly on your radio dial and podcast link. We're here at the home of cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Excuse the frog is still there in my throat, but it's slowly, gradually going away. But I am your host and executive producer, Charles D. Ellison, at the WEAA studios on the storied campus of Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. Find us at Ellison Report on Twitter. You can also go to WEAA.org, by the way, if you want to hear the podcast. People are like, well, where do you go for the podcast? Well, just go to, well, you can go to at Ellison Report too, because we take you directly there. Anyway, so a lot to cover. Obviously, there's so much going on in the world today. Policymakers have their work cut out for them when shaping K-12 education policy, and it's not too clear they know exactly what's the first step. Not only is the education environment that much more uncertain after contentious feuding on Capitol Hill these past few weeks, but there are some tensions over a wide range of areas, from the future of the classroom to relationships between the local, state, and federal level. Joining us for our special Voices of K-12 segment is Elena Silva. She's director of pre-K through 12 for the New America Foundation's Education Policy Program. You can get more on that at newamerica.org or find her at Elena_M_Silva on Twitter. Elena, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, so we don't talk enough about this nowadays, but how uncertain right now is the K-12 education environment? Is it sufficiently, at the end of the day, adequately preparing kids? I just want to kind of start with that from the top.
Is it adequately preparing kids? It's adequately preparing kids in the sense that our public school system is set up to serve all children and does a fairly good job of at least providing access to your basic education for all children. Mm-hmm. We still have big achievement gaps. We still have a lot of issues from pre-K all the way through higher education that face our nation that we're trying to address in policy. But we are serving children, and our education system is not as dire as some would paint.
Yeah, let me ask you, because I hear this question all the time from a lot of folks who aren't too familiar with the education landscape. How are we in comparison to other countries, other particularly developed countries?
Sure. Again, it depends on what you look at. If you look at the most recent data that the National Center on Education Statistics released, they released a report recently. Two things that stand out on that. One is that we actually spend a lot more money per student on education than a lot of other nations. But we have lower, in many cases, graduation rates. So that's meaningful, because you want to look at the amount of money you're spending and then the outcomes on the other end. And so graduation rates, in terms of our high school graduation rates, aren't as high. Related to that is the question of what does that really mean? What does a high school graduation mean today? Mm-hmm. And for education policymakers, part of what we're trying to do and part of the trend is to pay more attention to enrollment and to success in higher education and employment. So we're looking at longer-term outcomes. It's not just high school graduation that we want, although we do need that. It's also those other outcomes. So we're lagging a little bit on that. Another thing that's interesting about international comparison is that in the United States, kids tend to start school later. So you hear sometimes that in response to many of the state pushes and even federal pushes for pre-K and for early childhood education, which is certainly a trend and a positive one, you hear sometimes that other nations don't do that and that we're putting our kids in too early and we're institutionalizing them too early. The fact is that if you look at young children in other countries, kids in the United States are actually starting later than kids in France and Germany and the UK and other nations.
I didn't realize that. I'm just real curious. Can you add private and parochial schools in that mix? Is that data also collected and aggregated when you're looking at all of those outcomes and those graduation figures?
It is. It is and it isn't. I mean, if you look, it still holds those two trends. But yes, if you separate it out by private and parochial, you'll see slight differences, but the two trends still hold.
And now, so with this current, rather uncertain environment and, finally the nomination of Betsy DeVos that went through. She's education secretary. So there's still a lot of uncertainty there because there's still a lot of tension between obviously the Trump administration and a lot of different stakeholders and players. So how do educators and policymakers on all levels adapt to this new uncertain K-12 environment?
Well, it's a little bit of a wait and see in some respects, because this is it's moved the game to the states. Already this was going to happen regardless of who the Secretary of Education was, because we passed a new Every Student Succeeds Act, which is what replaced the No Child Left Behind Act. And that preceded DeVos's nomination and confirmation. And that effectively moved a lot of the federal regulation to the state. It gave states a lot more power to develop and design their own accountability systems. And now we have a situation where we have a Secretary of Education that he agrees with this and thinks even more so that the federal government is overreaching and that there should be less federal regulation. What states will do with that, with the combination of already being, you know, sort of set free by ESSA and then doubly so by Secretary DeVos, or her position or her stance on that, that may mean that states, they follow the plans they had been developing for years. It may also mean that the states decide to pivot and do something that we might not have expected. I don't imagine that states would change dramatically, since they have, as I said, been developing plans for accountability systems and how they prepare teachers and leaders and all the issues that fall under education. But we are watching closely to see what that impact will be on states. And of course, that would impact local districts as well.
You know, I'm not an expert on ESSA or the Every Student Succeeds Act, but from my understanding, there are provisions baked into that law, and that's an Obama administration era law that actually does it hand more power to the states? It hands more power to the federal government in terms of their oversight of the states, correct? And that's kind of baked into their housing.
It hands more power to the states.
To the states, exactly, correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
It changes the relationship that we had under NCLB, which
got
was
it.
Federally heavy, and now it moves it down to the states.
Okay. Got it. So now, looking at all that, what are your expectations on the roles of different levels of government? So we talked about the federal-state relationship in managing K-12 education. So what are these? Do you see, like, you know, sort of a different kaleidoscope of roles for not just the federal but also the state and also the local? And what are those? How are those relationships between those three levels managed when looking at what's ahead for us on K-12?
Well, education is a local issue. Decisions are made by the states primarily. The funding primarily comes from states and locals. The decisions mostly, again, starting at the state level, then move down to local education authorities, school districts mostly, and networks of schools, and then to the schools, and then decisions are made at the school level. There have been attempts in the past to devolve that a lot of the decision-making to schools, because there's a sense that, well, you know, if school leaders, had more of the ability to make decisions and to move things around, well, then schools would serve the needs of those students better. And so in places that happens, but primarily across the board, decisions are made at the state level. That includes state boards. And then it moves to the local level, and then it moves to the schools. The federal government has, under NCLB, No Child Left Behind, it had a fairly large degree of authority compared to previously and compared to now under ESSA, where it was very strong on accountability, and it was really pushing the states and mandating that the states have accountability systems that are looking across at all subgroups of kids that are reporting. I mean, there's a big emphasis on data and requirements of data. And I would anticipate that will continue, because people became used to that. They became accustomed to doing things that way and collecting data and feeling accountable, and that accountability would sort of trickle down, and there would be an impact or some sort of consequence. But they do have the freedom now to do it very differently if they choose.
You know, I did want to ask you about how schools are adapting to dramatic demographic changes. So, you know, especially with emphasis shifting to state local control. So, you know, you have the population becoming increasingly multi-complexioned and less white. Black and brown population groups collectively, they'll be the majority by 2050, I believe. So how are those population pressures shaping public education? How are they shaping education in general? So, like, for example, one worrisome trend we're seeing is the disproportionate amount of punishment meted out to children of color, being more likely to be suspended or expelled than white students. And so obviously that's problematic. And is that being factored in when we're shaping K through 12 policy?
Well, it certainly should be. And I will say that part of the purpose of No Child Left Behind's insistence on accountability was to address these subpopulations of kids, like Latino kids and African-American students mm-hmm. with disabilities, who had been ignored, you know, for decades. They really you didn't have to pay attention to subgroups in the same way. You didn't have to disaggregate the data. It was an attempt. Part of it was an attempt to do that. It was unsuccessful in many respects. No Child Left Behind had a lot of flaws, but and unintended consequences. But one positive one was that it did put a spotlight on those subgroups, and you know, sort of held up a mirror to our nation and said, hey, this is what this really looks like. This mm-hmm. is how these kids are being served and how they're not being served, or how they're being inequitably served.
Was that being done before, or that didn't happen until No Child Left Behind?
No, it really didn't happen until then. It happened here and there, but it wasn't part of federal policy. It certainly wasn't mm-hmm. part of the way our nation felt committed to and you know, had any sort of commitment to doing it. There was no need to do it. And in fact, if you look back, and it still happens now, unfortunately, and the fear is that it would revert to this, that you don't have to pay attention to whole populations, and that by aggregating everyone, by sort of treating, you know, everyone's the same, we're one big population, well, what happens when you do that is you miss these patterns and you miss these trends.
Mm-hmm.
We have there are big concerns now that under the Office of Civil Rights, which is in the Department of Education, that if that, as a part of a federal agency that folks in DeVos and Trump's administration wants to curb, or at least, you know, lessen the sort of federal oversight, that if, in fact, if you were to gut the Office of Civil Rights, or if you were no longer to have such a strong Office of Civil Rights, that we wouldn't be collecting information on that. And that part of the job of OCR and other entities like that is to collect information about different groups of students who are vulnerable for various reasons, and to report on it, and for there to be a way for people to report what's happening and what's not.
Hey, with technology increasingly entering the education space, how does that game change the K through 12 equation? Does it enhance it? Does it pose a new set of challenges? Are education systems prepared for it, for students relying increasingly on technology? And also the traditional school model is being dramatically changed as well. So, you know, you've got these blended learning models. You've got a mix of traditional classroom and online learning. You've got you know, folks, there's an increase in the amount of homeschooling now and reliance on technology. So how does that all game change it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, learning technologies are center stage in all of this, and mostly for better, although there are certainly challenges. So innovation and disruption have been two terms that have been really, I think, probably overused in the past years.
Yeah, I agree with you.
But the notion that public schools need to change, and not just in the way we test students or evaluate teachers, but in fundamentally, structurally redesigning schools to fit our world and the needs of our students is right. It's something we need to do, and it's something that's happening. I'm not sure we could stop it if we wanted to, and I think that's a good thing. We can offer instruction now in different ways at different times through different media, and we can connect systems in a way we couldn't before, and in ways we couldn't before. That has huge implications for schools and how they relate to libraries, to community centers, to other institutions of learning, to colleges. Mm. And what that means is, on the whole, more access for students. The question is it access to quality learning? So when we see some of the online models, certainly a lot of the for-profit models, we have to look very closely at whether they're offering something that's quality, and whether they're being predatory at all by trying to give easy access to low-income students, for example, who may not in the end get quality learning in exchange. So schools are fundamentally changing. It's part of the reason why charters have been so appealing. You know, they're new and they're fresh and they're different. And now with Secretary DeVos, we're seeing a resurgence of voucher proposals that are appealing for the same reason. They're different from the traditional model because the public recognizes, as policymakers do too, because we see in practice and in policy things changing, that schools need to redesign, they need to change, and technology is certainly a huge part of making that happen.
Elena, I've got to bring you back at some point. I'd had a lot of questions, particularly about school financing, but my time is up, so we got to bring you back, obviously. We've been talking with Elena Silva. She is director of Pre-K through 12 at the New America Foundation's Education Policy Program. Check out Elena at Elena_M_Silva. Elena, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charles. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
All right, you too. Take care. Up next is American University's Jordan Tama on whether there really is a Trump foreign policy. We don't know. Well, I don't know, Jordan. He's about to help us through that, sort it out. Here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from Island Press, more at islandpress.org, and from partners like BE Strategy, Strategy, Research, Communications, more at strategybe.com. Let President Trump tell it one day, and the White House is running like a finely tuned, well-oiled machine. Let him tweet it the next, and the country is rudderless. Actually, I'm quoting him, as if it's running without a president. That's just one small snapshot of the schizophrenia inside the White House, and it seems to get worse with each passing report of a scandal involving now former very short-lived National Security Council advisor Michael Flynn. Yet beyond Flynn, it feels worse, from mixed signals on the Middle East, Asia, and NATO, to openly sharing sensitive information at a posh Florida resort. To make sense of it all is Jordan Tama. He's professor at the School of International Service at American University, specializing in foreign relations. JordanTama.com for more information. You can also go to American.edu. Thanks for joining us, Professor. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
All right. So amid all this chaos, as you're sifting through the wreckage of just a month of the Trump administration, can you make out a clear, coherent Trump foreign policy, a Trump doctrine, if you will?
Well, I think the clearest overall doctrine is to focus on a narrow view of American interests in foreign policy. He wants to keep people out of the United States who might be dangerous. He wants to restrict trade that could threaten some American jobs. Those ideas might sound good in principle, but they make it a lot harder for the United States to engage positively with the world. And the reality is we live in a globalized world where we really benefit a lot from international exchange, economic exchange, immigration. And so these are ideas that I think are harmful for the United States. But it's a very kind of narrow view of the U.S. role in the world, no sense of United States being able to be a force for good in the world, accomplish positive things, act on behalf of humanitarian goals, improve conditions in countries overseas, some things like that, which have been part of U.S. foreign policy for many years. Trump doesn't seem to think they're important.
Okay. And how long can that go on before we start to see real problems or a troubling visual of the consequences of that sort of worldview?
Well,
I know it's very hard to tell, but just kind of riffing here and seeing what your thought is on that.
I think there's a danger of the United States getting into some dangerous crises under Trump, because he has shown that he's willing to make statements, take positions almost spontaneously. It seems he, wakes up in the morning and has an idea, and then he might send out a tweet, which could have some serious international ramifications. He's shown that he's sometimes willing to insult foreign leaders. There was a call that he had with the Prime Minister of Australia, which was reported, where he was quite rude to the Prime Minister of Australia. And in that kind of attitude can get the United States into some difficult situations and potentially even conflict. He has taken a very tough line towards China on, in some occasions, but in a way that's not really well thought through. So I think there's a risk of a military confrontation. And he doesn't have a deliberative process for making decisions. He seems to make very rash decisions. He doesn't really consult with a lot of people, use his advisors effectively. And so there's a greater chance that he'll just make a bad decision on some important issue.
Now, you had mentioned that call with the Australian Prime Minister. So, but what I noticed also weeks later, reading sort of intelligence on how there is a planned expansion of the U.S. military presence there in Australia as part of their Pacific strategy or their Asia strategy, so or their China containment strategy. So obviously there were some previous or agreements that were put in place prior to Trump entering the White House during the Obama administration. I mean, can, despite you sort of this chaotic mess of a foreign policy start for the Trump administration, can we assume that some of these agreements, particularly when it comes to the placement of military forces throughout the world, can some of those agreements still stay in place? Can they remain solid?
I think a lot of that will stay in place. I think, you know, ultimately Trump's probably going to change some of these things at the margins, but not a great deal. The biggest examples are the U.S. military alliances with a number of countries overseas, NATO, with Europe. We have military alliances with Japan, South Korea, Australia. Trump has criticized these alliances, said he wants other countries to take on more of the burden of protecting themselves, but I don't think he's going to actually pull out of these relationships or completely curtail the deployment of U.S. troops to these countries. And some of the things he says have some merit. I mean, there are, in some of these relationships, Europe, for instance, with NATO, European countries actually should be contributing more to defense, because the United States has been paying a lot more towards its defense budget than European countries have. But Trump goes about this in such a kind of heavy-handed way that it's going to turn off other countries and not really be a productive way to get them to, you know, make any changes that might be in our interest. And he's become very unpopular overseas, so it makes it hard for him to actually, you know, persuade other governments to do things that he might be asking, because other governments, if they do what he asks, are probably going to be unpopular domestically, because he's so unpopular domestically because of the way he talks and, you know, the perception that he's not respectful of their own, you know, interests.
And there's got to be a huge trust gap there. So if I were a foreign leader, I'd be a bit nervous about having sensitive, confidential discussions with President Trump, correct? Or I noticed the look on Japanese Prime Minister Abe's face when at that scene where everyone's sitting at the table in the Mar-a-Lago resort and there's news about the North Korean missile launch, and Trump is showing off like content which we assume is classified sensitive material on his phone, and there just seemed to be this look of, I don't know, a little dismay. I mean, he was very guarded and very reserved, Abe, which he normally is. I mean, he's got a great sort of poker face, if you will. But I noticed a little bit dismay there. And so I would think other foreign leaders are watching that and they're like, should I be having sensitive conversations with this president?
Yeah, I think that's a real concern. And Trump has definitely had a cavalier attitude in the way that he's dealt with information. And I think foreign governments are going to be wary of sharing sensitive information with him. Also, there have been a lot of leaks coming out of the White House, not some of which may be coming from Trump himself, others coming from some of his advisors. But in general, there's just a lot of leaks coming out of the White House. And so that'll be concerning to any foreign government. The intelligence community, the U.S. intelligence community, there was even a report in the news today, is itself withholding some information from Trump, which is really remarkable, because the purpose of the intelligence community generally is to actually serve the president, to help the president make good decisions. And yet there are intelligence agencies that are now concerned about sharing their information with the president because they feel that he may not treat it properly. So that's really disturbing.
Yeah, that's disturbing. That's remarkable, though, however. Real quick question on that. So the intelligence community in doing that, and we understand why they do that, but at the same time, they feel confident that they can make decisions on their own without presidential consent or approval?
Well, they can't really make policy decisions. I mean, so the intelligence agency's role really is to provide information and advice, but not be the decision maker. So they can't really be making decisions on their own. They are on some issues that are very, very sensitive. They are showing that they're wary of sharing the information with the president. The president still can be making decisions, but he may not have all the best information, and so that's a problem. And Trump has there's kind of already a vendetta here between Trump and the intelligence agencies because Trump has been criticizing the intelligence agencies because he thinks they have it out for him because they have issued these reports saying that Trump's campaign had connections with Russia and that Russia was trying to influence the election on his behalf. And so Trump has already sort of antagonized this part of the government. He's antagonized a lot of the government, you know, government bureaucracy. He seems to have a lot of disdain for. And so a lot of the bureaucracy, not just the intelligence agencies, but a lot of our government agencies are now, you know, going to be not helpful to him. And there's going to be a lot of conflict between the White House and those agencies, which is also bad for our country.
All right. We've been talking with Jordan Tommy. He's a professor at the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C. He's been joining us by phone. You can go to jordantama.com for more information on him. You can catch his CV there. Professor, thanks so much again, man. We'll talk to you.
Okay. Thanks so much for having me on.
All right. Take care. Next, it's Linkin Park Strategies to Fon Hankin on how Democrats look now if an election were held today. Here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Back at the LSO Report, made possible by support from K-12, a provider of online educational solutions, more at K12.com. Also, don't forget about listeners like you who support efforts like this. Find out more about how you too can contribute at WEAA.org. Hint, just click on donate. All right, so while the Trump White House is in turmoil, you got to give it to them. Republicans, along with Donald Trump, still know how to win an election, right? They still want it. And the way it looks, there's no stop to a constant electoral juggernaut of GOP wins for the foreseeable future. That's just how it stands right now. Democrats might be feeling themselves a bit as protests and marches keep popping up throughout America's cities. But how good is that if it's taking so long to pick a party chair and there's no clear indication of a 3-year electoral plan? Is it that grim for Democrats, though? And, oh, yeah, how do Republicans look? Here to talk about that is our good friend, Stefan Hankin. He's founder and president of Linkin Park Strategies. More at LP Strategies on Twitter or lpstrategies.com. Stefan, how are you doing, sir?
Doing all right. Thanks for having me back on.
Right. So we were just joking about that before the break, how we hadn't had you back on for a while. And you were like, are these guys going to call me back? Because, you know, my forecast may have been a little off last year in 2016. No, We always like having you on, Stefan.
Oh, I appreciate that. I wouldn't have called me back, but I appreciate that you did.
So let me ask you, man, and I'm going to ask you about polling a little bit later on in the segment. How do Democrats look now electorally? Are they in reasonable enough shape to begin pushing or engineering electoral threats to Republicans in ways that can alter the landscape back in their favor?
do you want the honest answer, or do you want the company
just
line?
Just keep it real. Just real talk.
So, look, there's clearly a lot of, I'll say, wind behind the backs of Democrats right now. You know, you referenced the marches, the protests at the airport. You know, we're seeing this in donations to campaigns. You know, this is sort of the reverse after the 08 election of President Obama, where, you know, that sprung the Tea Party, and that's where that the energy was. I mean, you know, we clearly have a lot of energy, mm-hmm. but now, to your point of the question is, you know, where does that energy go and what does it mean? And, you know, if we look at the U.S. Senate map, 2018 is beyond ugly for Democrats. You know, we're at 48 seats now. We're looking at reelection campaigns in states like Montana, Indiana, North Dakota, Michigan, Missouri, you know, all West Virginia, all which are going to be really tough. And then the only pickup opportunities that are really out there are Nevada and I guess Arizona with Senator Jeff Flake, but that's a push. So, you know, even if it's like, if we would have to hold everyone, and then, you know, I'm kind of looking at it, I'm like, okay, I could maybe make an argument for two seats, which puts us at 50, which still leaves us in the minority. Now, if you flip over to the House, you know, the districts are tough. But I mean, it's one of those, like, the House, if the next 2 years are the same as the last month, yeah, I think there's a chance that the Democrats might actually win the House back, because it's going to be that bad. But you know, we're going to have to sort of wait to see how things go out. And, you know, a lot of Democrats, and I agree with this, you know, 100%, have been pushing that, look, you know, we got to start focusing on the states, right? Like, we got to start winning back some of these state legislatures. We got to focus on governorships, you know, secretaries of state, positions like that. When it comes to the 2020 redistricting, that's going to be key. And let's start focusing on those races. And, you know, so, and I think there's a lot of, you know, a lot of efforts moving in that direction. And then, you know, we'll see what happens when the new DNC chair comes in and who it is and which direction they start heading things in. So, you know, there's obviously a lot going on. But right now, you know, Democrats are angry, and they're certainly organized right now.
What kind of messaging could resonate in this current environment? So there's a battle within the Democratic Party, obviously, over who should run it. You know, it's progressives versus pragmatists. I guess that's a way to characterize it. But it's not clear if there's a discussion on how to somehow persuade certain groups like Trump supporters from the dark side, so to speak. So what's the resonant message?
Yeah, well, if you ask the pragmatists, which I guess I'll put myself in that camp, look, you know, there are a bunch of people out there who voted for Trump who should not be happy right now. You know, that was the crowd that was kind of like, like, I don't really like Hillary Clinton. Like, there's no way he's going to do everything he's saying he's going to do. Like, let's just give him a chance and, you know, hey, at least my taxes might go down. and... You know, and it's like those folks that it's like, you know, I kind of look at them like, look, that's who we need to win over, right? Like, in these tough to win congressional districts or state Senate districts or state House districts, like, we need the sort of the more moderate Republicans to be like, this is insane and I'm not signing up for this anymore, or at least I'm not signing up for it this year. Now, the progressives, you know, I'm obviously generalizing here, would sort of argue, you know, we need to move to the left. We need to be, you know, populist. We need to, you know, that's how we're going to pull people in. I don't personally see the math behind it, but, you know, but that is a line of thinking. And, you know, and again, I think not that the DNC chair, like, dictates this 100%, but I think it'll be a little bit clearer of which direction the party's likely to go, depending on who gets into that position.
So let's get to those state level plays. Some of them are right around the corner, and I'm not hearing any conversation on those. I know you just said that there is some conversation starting to steer in that direction. But I'm just wondering how urgent is that? Because, you know, next week, the state senates of Delaware, Connecticut, and Washington could flip from Democrat to Republican. Nobody knows about that. Nobody really knows. And later on, we may see New Jersey continue a streak of winning GOP gubernatorial candidates, even after a very unpopular Chris Christie leaves. And in Virginia, not only will the current Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe, likely get replaced by a Republican, Ed Gillespie, But Democrats are going to let a prime opportunity slip with the state legislature. What's really going on there? I mean, and let me ask you about progressives too. I mean, are they aware of this? Because, you know, when you look at these protests, you look at the Twitter feeds, you look at all the conversation and rhetoric taking place, no one's saying anything about these states. And I'm wondering, what's going on there? Why aren't they somehow transferring that protest energy into those five specific states that I just named?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, an incredibly valid question that this needs to be a part of the conversation, where it's, you know, it is one thing to, you know, to march in the streets, and it's one thing to, you know, protest at the airports and, you know, delete Uber and all these things, which I, you know,
right.
I'm 100% behind. But, you know, like, at the end of the day, if we're not affecting electoral outcomes, all of this is for naught, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, next Saturday, there, you know, we're going to be looking at the Delaware State Senate is going to go one way or the other. And, you know, it's not getting a ton of attention. I mean, the challenge with the state.
And that's Biden's state. That's like Joe Biden's state.
Talked about more, but, you know, it's sometimes it's tough to get people to get excited about a state that's not there. Cause I really like,
yeah.
How does the state Senate in Delaware really affect my life? But it's, you know, I mean, this is something that the Republicans have been excellent at for, I mean, at least going back to 2010, if not earlier, and we see this with like groups like Americans for Prosperity and the Koch brothers, like they understand it, right? Like
Yeah. They're
getting involved in school board elections and, you know, dog catcher races because, you know, for two reasons. One is this builds your bench, but then also, you know, a lot of policy can get affected at the local level regardless of what's happening sort of up at the top. So, you know, if you're controlling school boards, all of a sudden, you know, what, in the view of the Republicans, like what the Obama administration is doing through the Department of Ed doesn't matter quite as much because they have control over the local. And it's less sexy. It's less exciting. But it's, you know, it's, this is how it works. And, you know, and I would certainly say that, you know, Democrats need to start really rethinking what they're going after, because we're really good at the, like, the shiny objects, right? So it's like, we have no problem giving a lot of money to congressional races. In fact, you know, the DCCC has spent something close to $540 million over the last three election cycles, and we've got a net loss of six seats over those three election cycles, right? Which is a horrible return on investment.
Wait, how much again?
It's about $540
million. half a billion, okay.
Yeah, for negative six, right? And, I mean, and it doesn't cost that much to run local elections. It's just,
but
they're not as sexy, right? They don't sell quite as well.
Right.
But, you know, we really need people to start thinking through this and really, like, what would you rather have, right? You're like, do you want the shiny car or do you want to be able to drive, like, dictate, you know,
right.
who gets to drive on the highway?
Right. Right, exactly. So, you know, I got you for about three more minutes. I wish I had you for more time, but I mentioned the here and now, 2017. But how does 2018 look? I've got to ask you again, as far, you know, you're looking at, if you're able to look that far out, like if an election like the midterms were held today. And I know you went a little bit into that earlier in the segment, but looking at, I'm real curious about the House again, as far as like how Dems would. Well, let's not just 2018, but let's look at the White House, like in 2020. I mean, are you collecting data for that as well?
Real early. I mean, we're obviously always keeping eyes on things and where are the trends heading and where are folks. And I mean, you know, I have a tough time imagining if we have 4 years of this. That, you know, who's ever going to be on the Democratic side isn't going to have a very strong, you know, chance of winning this thing back. You know, I mean, I'm almost looking at it, I'm like, I can't even imagine that Trump can, like, make it through 4 years if this is the pace that we're going on.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, I mean, we haven't even gotten to legislation yet, which is just mind-boggling of, like, how much has happened. And really, there hasn't even really been, like, a bill voted on and signed yet. Like, how crazy things are. So, you know, there's a lot going on. And obviously, you know, so it's tough to know what's going to be happening in 2 years and in 4 years and things like that. But, you know, my general sense is if this pattern continues, at least, you know, even at like half the level that it's at now, I mean, you know, I think Democrats are certainly going to be much more engaged than they typically are for an off-year election, a non-presidential year election. And I think, you know, there are also a lot of voting groups, you know, particularly minority voters, women, who, you know, didn't turn out necessarily in as high numbers as they were expected to in 2016. We saw a few groups sort of slip a little bit. So, you know, Clinton did worse than Obama among some key groups. And I think those groups are starting to realize the sort of the what can happen if you know, if you're not engaging. And, you know, and certainly I'm not just putting that on the voters. I mean, you know, like the Clinton campaign did a very bad job of engaging a lot of people in some very key states. So this isn't just, oh, you know, like, let's blame the voters. But, you know, I think people are starting to realize, like, yeah, this is real, right? Like, this is affecting our lives, and this is, we got to do whatever we can to stop this. And, you know, we'll see if that continues through the next 2 and 4 years.
I did want to ask you, I think I got about, what, another 2 minutes? Another minute. The polling industry. So conventional view is that polling did not score so well in 2016, obviously due to Trump's election. But you're a bit more optimistic. There's going to be an uptick in business, correct?
Yeah, I mean, so typically for, you know, for us, and certainly, you know, look, we deserve some lumps for 2016. And, you know, but like looking forward, you know, typically when there are a lot of unknowns, when there's disruption, when things are moving away from the status quo, that tends to be good for business, because we just have a lot more of our clients who just are trying to figure out, like, what does this mean for us? How do we handle this new situation? So, you know, like, I'm not in the camp of, like, oh, polling's going away. I mean, you know, we're always adjusting. We're always changing the way we're collecting data and how we're analyzing it. And now, you know, we've certainly learned a lot from 2016. But, you know, like, everything is evolving and keeps changing, but I think overall, I think the industry is here to stay, and I think, you know, a lot of us will probably be pretty busy over the next few years.
All right, Stefan Hanke. Well, you'll be busy because you'll be coming back here on with us in the coming weeks and months and years ahead. Stefan Hanke, Lincoln Park Strategies, at LP Strategies on Twitter, LPStrategies.com as well online. Stefan, thanks as always, man. Really appreciate it.
Great to be back, and thanks for having me.
All right. Up next is WEAA contributor Peter Groff and Emory University's Andre Gillespie on yet another surreal week in Washington. Prepare for more of that. Here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from partners like BE Strategy and from listeners like you. Go to weaa.org for more information on how you can contribute. Andre Gillespie is a professor of political science at Emory University. She's also author of the newly released Race in the Obama Administration, Substance, Symbols, and Hope. You can find her at Andre Gillespie. And Peter Groff, former Obama appointee, is our WEAA contributor. He's at Peter C. Groff. You can catch him as well. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
So where to begin? let's start off with that recent hot mess of a press conference. Andre, I'm going to start with you on this. I wanted to get your take on that. What was the play here? What was the president attempting to accomplish after a tumultuous week? He seems to keep grabbing for that campaign trail trick bag, and I'm wondering if that works still.
You know, I think we have to hold out the possibility that this does work with his base, and that in many ways he's playing to his base, and so he goes back to what's familiar mm-hmm. to him and then what is tried and true with him. Mm. So, you know, criticizing Hillary Clinton, you know, to remind people of why they elected him
right.
in the first place, deflecting attention away from his own faults, putting his own spin on how to interpret his first month in office. because of underlying mistrust of the media. I think that that was all there. I saw reports where people talked about him rambling. That's his general style. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, that wasn't particularly surprising. I just think that it was really amplified, and because he hasn't given very many press conferences in the last few months, I think that that was also part of the reason why it was such a jolt.
Mm-hmm. Peter, so you know, he's trying to galvanize his base, and you know, he's not even worried about the rest of the country, because right now his base, they're the ones who come out and vote, right? I mean, that's sort of his logic, that, you know what, they when I need them, they come out, they turn out. And right now, there's nothing on the horizon that poses an electoral threat to him or his fellow Republicans on the Hill, correct? That's his logic right now.
Well, nothing in the next couple of weeks, but you have to begin to think about the midterm elections in 2018, and I suspect that the Republicans on the Hill are beginning to get a little nervous here, because there are some seats where Democrats, I think, once they elect their new leader February 25th in Atlanta, that's going to be the direction. And I think there are some Republican members who are in districts that are purple or purplish, mm-hmm. that are very, very nervous about what happens every time the president fires off a tweet at 3 in the morning or has an hour and 17-minute press conference where you just are left shaking your head thinking, what the heck did I just watch? Mm-hmm. And so I think there's going to be a whole lot of nerves that are going to be jangled on the Hill if this continues. And you're right, the professor's right, it really plays with the base. But the base didn't necessarily get him elected. It was those suburban white women mm-hmm. who didn't particularly like Hillary Clinton, who were concerned about the emails. Remember the emails?
Oh, yeah.
Are now thinking, what did I just do? Right. And I think they have to start thinking in the White House, and there's really
That's a documentary, Peter. That's a documentary. like, what did I just do? And you can, you can just interview just like dozens of suburban white women. Right. It's like a Netflix documentary. I didn't mean to cut you off. I just had that visual, but go ahead.
But I think the lack of a mainstream traditional political leader in the White House is lacking, and it's beginning to show with everything that they roll out or kind of stumble out. And I think that the folks on the Hill who are trying to maybe get some things done from a traditional conservative Republican direction are beginning to get a little nervous.
Hey, Andra, but there's still a lot of time between now and 2018 for the Trump White House and for Republicans to recuperate. And there's two reasons for that. One is that this kind of happened in 2016, where things sort of reached that critical mass as far as the management of the Trump campaign. But then he brought in Kellyanne Conway, and then they put the ship, you know, on course. And everything turned out well. He got elected. I go back to the government shutdown, where congressional Republicans acted like they were all nervous, but people have very short memory span. So by 2018, folks are going to forget, and this gives the Trump administration enough time for congressional Republicans to intervene and for the Trump White House to steer itself, correct?
Well, I mean, I think that there are a couple of underlying traits to keep in mind in thinking about how people view President Trump. He was elected on a change mandate. So there were people who went in with the logic that if you want Washington to change, then you shouldn't put a career politician into office. And so in that respect, Trump is viewed as a breath of fresh air. Hmm. And so those of us who play inside the Beltway or think as though we play inside the Beltway look at the change that he's bringing. If you're liberal, you don't like the substance of it. And from a procedural standpoint, there's a lot to be alarmed by just in terms of normal organizational processes mm-hmm. and then also how those organizational processes fit constitutional mandates, for instance, and whether or not we're actually following laws and following the Constitution. But for other people, they may be looking at this going, we want to change. Okay, this is change. And so they like the fact that it's a jolt. They like the fact that he doesn't follow convention. And so for that reason, it's going to be weird. You know, if you look at Gallup, you know, Gallup has President Trump with a net negative approval rating, but there is an acknowledgement amongst voters that he's keeping his promises, and there's still a perception that he's a strong leader.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I think we have to wait to see how high our tolerance is for how Trump operates and whether or not that's viewed as chaotic. So I think I think one person's chaos is another person's refreshing change, and I think we have to acknowledge that people view these things through through different lenses. And I also think that just because this has been chaotic, the first month of the Trump administration has been chaotic, it doesn't mean that the Trump administration of September 2018 is necessarily going to look that way. I don't know. I don't want to predict. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think part of the problem with the shutdown was the shutdown happened in 2013. Mm-hmm. And so Republicans had a year to recuperate. And we're also in a period where the Democratic Party is still trying to figure out what its message is. And right now, we don't know what that message will look like. We'll know next week once we know who the DNC chair is. And then once they're in office, we'll see whether or not that person can actually help craft a message and can actually help build an organization that can be competitive in 2018.
And you make a good point, because when you're looking at some of these latest polls that are coming out, you still got that, on average, so that consistent 30% of the population, 30, maybe a little more, that is feeling like Trump is doing what he's supposed to be doing. So that's just been consistent across the board since, like, birther story, right? It's just, it's always this 30% of the population which just stands behind him or stands behind his sort of nonsense. So, Peter, what did you make of this new narrative that he, I'm quoting him, inherited a mess? I inherited a mess. What's that all about? So is that a revisitation of the first black president? He just didn't say President Obama's name, but he's talking about he inherited a mess. That's the new narrative, correct? That's where he's going.
Well, I don't know if it's a new narrative, but it certainly is one that he's driven home ever since he came down on the escalator to announce his candidacy. And again, that plays with the base. The question is, can you use that to continue to kind of paper over or voice over the chaos that's going in within your own White House? That will be the question between now and the end of the year when people begin to start thinking about the congressional elections. But it sets up well for the Republicans if you're able to drive that message home, because of where the Senate seats that are up are in play. And they're on the Republican side of the map, if you will, as well as the redistricted congressional seats. It'll be incredibly difficult for Democrats to pick up. So if you can continue to play that that card and get some things done, if you can get an infrastructure bill passed, if you can figure out a way to begin to really dive into tax reform and continue to get things done that you promised it. Yes, that narrative, I think, will help certainly drive out the base as he cleans up what that last guy left him. And, you know, even though it's an alternative fact and you look at everything that President Obama faced, what he was able to do, and the fact that it wasn't a mess that he inherited, it doesn't really matter. If you continue to say that, if you say it loud enough, long enough, people will think it's true.
We got about several good minutes left. So, Andrew, real quick, about turning out the base, Democrats turning out their base. We've got some major state races coming up. And where are Democrats? So you got next week, you're going to have Connecticut, Delaware, Washington State up for grabs. They could flip. Their state senates could flip to Republican. You got New Jersey and Virginia coming up. Democrats aren't talking about that. What's that all about?
Well, I mean, I think once the national DNC leadership is in, and then, I mean, and this is also an issue for the state parties and a question of whether or not the national party can support the state parties to be strong, then you'll be able to see whether or not Democrats can make inroads in a hostile political environment. Mm-hmm. So there are things that are against them. So we're at the end of the decade, so districts have already been drawn, and if those and in places where state legislatures were controlled by Republicans when district lines were drawn, you know, it's difficult to make inroads there. But it becomes the challenge of the Democratic Party to be able to craft their message, recruit candidates, and run a ground operation that can actually rally their base to them. I mean, I think the other big challenge that the Democratic Party is facing right now is that, and it's not just what happened last fall, but it's also what happened in 2014 as well, we have to expect that whites are becoming a shrinking portion of the Democratic electorate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the challenge for the Democratic Party is how do you build a multiracial coalition that includes whites? But not only does that involve trying to win some white voters back to the Democratic Party, it would be finding ones who might be on the more progressive end of the scale who didn't vote for Hillary Clinton to bring them back into the Democratic fold.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, are you maximizing turnout amongst your minority populations?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a both-and type of combination, and I think there has to be a realization that you cannot rely solely on, you know, high turnout amongst African Americans, because that doesn't always work in off-year elections,
mm-hmm.
And 90% Democratic voting rates among African Americans to push people over the top. Like, the Democratic coalition has to be multicultural, and they've got to figure out a way to speak to all the disparate parts of their coalition.
Mm-hmm. I did want to ask you both about, going back to that press conference, that moment with April Ryan. Oh, geez, got about a minute. Peter, real quick, what did that moment with April Ryan say about his black outreach efforts, black media, and what did it say about the CBC? I'll end with you, Peter.
It was one of those situations where you looked and thought, did he really just say that? But I do think it says quite a bit because, you know, initially she said, are you going to reach out to the CBC? He said, who? He didn't know, I don't think, what CBC was until she said the Congressional Black Caucus.
Right.
And so I think it says quite a bit about the total lack, I was going to say her name, the total lack of outreach, even through his congressional folks, to members of the CBC, but also the CBC pushing. They sent a letter early on, I think it was dated January 19th, that everybody's seen online. But it didn't necessarily ask for a visit. And now they're beginning to push.
Mm.
And it outlined several things. I think there were five or six things that were outlined, which I think were good things that would make a huge difference in the African-American community, building on what President Obama did. But they're going to be the ones that are going to have to now push on this and say, this is exactly what we want, not only with the White House, but with their leaders in Capitol Hill on both sides of the aisle.
All right. So I wish I had more time with you two. There's a lot to talk about, but I'll have you back on. Andrea Gillespie, check out her new book, Race and the Obama Administration, Substance, Symbols, and Hope. Andrea, I have to talk to you about that.
It's not going to be out till later this summer.
Oh, my God. Did I? Okay, sorry about that. I'm excited about it, you can tell. So I got to get the galley, so we got to do a book review segment in the summer. And at Andrea Gillespie on Twitter, and also Peter Groff, WEAA contributor. He's at Peter C. Groff. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. That wraps this week's edition of the Ellison Report. I'm your host, Charles Ellison. Big ups to Andre Melton, Tyron Rice, digital producer Ali Post, and others at WEAA. Touch base at Ellison Report on Twitter. Continue to listen in at the home of cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.